thatgreatbusinessshow.com is brought to you by DeFacto Shaving Oil, the best anyone can get. Made in Ireland, sold worldwide.
Welcome to episode 79 of That Great Business Show, posting on St. Patrick's Day, the 17th of March, 2022. I'm Conal O'Moran. Being the week that's in it, we thought something cultural would be appropriate. So we found a husband and wife team whose business is getting visitors to Ireland who pay to play our national games. And given what's happening to the global price of energy, we thought it was a good idea to have the chief of an oil exploration company in studio to give us some real facts about alternatives to Russian oil and gas. And if you think that the booze business is oversupplied with locally made liquor, we have a former Pernod Ricard MD, currently a Clonakilty distillery director, with us to see if he thinks there are any gaps left in the market. That Great Business Show is the home of great business insights, all brought to you thanks to our great sponsor, DeFacto Shaving Oil. Man or woman, it's the best anyone can get. Buy it right now on DeFactoShave.com. Now, if, like me, you get confused between boomers, millennials, Gen Y and the like, I can remind you that millennials are aged between 20 and 40. A little bit more digging shows that a whopping 72% or more than almost three quarters of US millennials who spent, wait for it, $200 billion on travel in 2018 want to spend on travel experiences rather than on physical possessions. So that is not a bad market to aim for. Now, a company I came across thanks to a big fan of the podcast, a man called Jerry Breen, who introduced me to Experience Gaelic Games Limited. The business, a social enterprise founded in 2009, hosts international guests in local GAA clubs at the heart of local communities with a series of specially devised activities with operations in Dublin, Galway, Cork and Belfast. Cormac O'Donoghue is co-founder of Experience Gaelic Games, along with his wife Georgina Carraher. And Cormac joins me now in studio. Fáilte rud, Cormac.
Good meal, Margaret Connell.
Where did you come up with this? Rather, I was going to say clever, but I'm actually going to use another word. It's kind of an obvious idea, but I wouldn't have thought of it.
It was a strange and a strange series of influences, I think, which brought us to today, or brought us to the foundation of Experience Gaelic Games. A combination of our own personal circumstances, myself and good wife Georgina, our availability. Also, at the time, we have, like many in the country, with our children, we're deeply involved in Gaelic games and in our local club in Nafina in Glasnevin. And if you can cast our mind back, which seems like a number of lifetimes ago now, back to the joys of 2008 and 2009 when we suffered our financial crash, it occurred to us when, at the time, I was sitting on the executive of Nafina, we were sitting on some wonderful and beautiful facilities that lay idle most of the daytime. And we also, as a club, were still obliged to fund the banking society to ensure that we remained in possession of those. So a combination of all those factors, and a very unusual experience that we had when myself and Georgina travelled for a weekend away to Galway. We met two American visitors who were very pleasant individuals, but they just explained to us that they had spent 4 days on the island and that we were the first Irish person that they'd spoken to. So a combination of that and a passion for Gaelic games and a belief in the in such a seismic cultural impression which Gaelic games has and leaves on our own psyche, that we decided to devise a method to try and explain Gaelic culture and the separateness and uniqueness of Irish modern Irish life through the medium of Gaelic games. So
how does it work?
It is a very simple concept, but remarkably, it's a different take and maybe a different explanation of Gaelic games and their importance in Irish life than we would normally have for us as locals. So we bring international guests into local Gaelic clubs and we spend a little bit of time entertaining them by telling them a little bit about the history of the games, particularly their cultural effect and the uniqueness of the GAA in the sense that it's not just a sporting organisation, but a sporting and cultural and social organisation, effectively with an indigenous tribal structure. and that delivers a passion and continues the millennial or the millenniums, I should say, of passion that the Gaels have had on this island for sport as a representation of your local tribal or ethnic background, right back to Cú Chulainn. All the way through to Liam McCarthy.
Oh, I can see those nights go on now if you start talking about Cú Chulainn, etc. So how long does that chat last and what else do they get?
Well, our format is that we welcome our guests in and I suppose based on the earlier comment of understanding that what people are looking for really is engagement. So we spend a bit of time with our guests, welcoming them to the localities, introducing them to their coaches.
Are we talking about an hour, half a day?
It takes about a half an hour for us to go through our general introduction. Initially, we show some audio visual clips as well, somewhat dramatised maybe for the purposes of entertainment, but all based on fact. And then
this will be
what we do,
clips of handbags and rough stuff, and
we keep a little bit about it. It's a focus for us to present the positive sides, so to speak. So there's not so much of a schmozzles going on for them. But then we take our guests out then to play a range of three of our indigenous games, sports or pastimes. So we coach them in the basic skills of Gaelic football, handball, and indeed then we have specially devised equipment which is more safety conscious to introduce them to the ancient art of Amount.
Get away. What do you train them with?
Well, we have a specially devised hurling stick, effectively, which is a lighter ball. But the stick itself has a bit of a rubber carbonised boss. It doesn't eliminate the potential for injury, but it certainly reduces it significantly.
And did you have to introduce this for insurance purposes, or?
Well, part of what we try to do, and part of the challenge that one of the challenges that we faced when we started was that many of our clients, indeed many within the tourism industry or the travel industry, are very reluctant for their clients to engage in physical activities, and the thoughts of them flaking wooden sticks at each other was a bit of a barrier for us. So
even though it was loved by the Queen of England, she loves Imoin, doesn't she?
Yeah, mind you, I hadn't seen her quite swing the stick yet, but we devised a little to introduce some more safety to it, and it's been very successful, and it keeps our clients and our visitors as safe as we possibly can.
And who are we talking about now, about your clients and visitors? Where are they coming from? What ages? How many of them? How much does it cost? I ask that question again. How much does it cost?
Well,
it's a business after all.
Yeah. Life is all determined now, or is all viewed through the spectrum of COVID. So I suppose we refer at this stage now to our pre-COVID existence. And in our pre-COVID existence, we were entertaining about 30,000 visitors a year.
Whoa.
Across a range of locations throughout the island.
That's a lot of people.
In relation to 10 million visits to the island per year, it's a relatively small number in a sense.
But when I saw this, first of all, I actually thought it was quite niche.
No,
30,000 is not niche in my book.
No, but again, our focus, while people hear about us first as experienced Gaelic games, they assume that it's about a physical or sporting challenge. For us, it's a crash course and it's cultural immersion in a day. It's an explanation of what it means to be Irish, although it's delivered to the prism of Gaelic games and the uniqueness of the games and their status within Irish society. So we deal across a range of sectors, everything from the very obvious, which one would assume with sporting groups, including elite sporting groups, who arrived to the island. So we were pre-COVID looking forward again to welcome the team from Notre Dame and from Navy. But we're hoping to welcome Nebraska maybe later on this year. We've hosted Penn State, the Nittany Lions, and the Boston Eagles from Boston College when they were here for the last college game, along with the Welsh international soccer team, the Fijian rugby team. So all those elite.
I can see that kind of thing working because people say, I want to occupy our players or our athletes for a set period of time. Do you get drop-ins? Do you get Mrs. Murphy or Mr. Murphy from Nebraska just coming by and saying, I'd like to get involved?
Yes, we do. And we work, I suppose there's a number of different sectors within the travel industry, which we've become familiar with. Obviously, there's a group travel and group booking, which we specialise in. But there's also what we call the FIT, or free and independent travel sector, which are the individuals who book. And they book online and pop into us. A very, very interesting area of the business. We tend to get to spend, and we're very privileged to get to spend a half a day in the company of a mixed bag of visitors, and engaging with them for that period of time. So it's a it's a really positive experience, and in some ways, for us, this has always been a passion as much as it's been it has to be commercially viable. But really, it's driven by our own series of passions, and also as a social enterprise, because it's important that it upholds the values of the association, which we're committed to, and also it delivers for our community. So it ticks so many boxes for us in the sense that it delivers for our local community, and it's also a means for us to communicate the positive values of community and volunteer engagement.
What ages are the people now? Okay, your elite athletes would be presumably in their 20s, but your, what did you call them?
The FIT, our free and independent travellers. A range, it's very interesting because as we've progressed, we've learned that we deal with different sectors. Some, again, we would have many multi-generational American families, which without stereotyping too much, normally tend to be the grandparents, and normally the mother and child, because the father is normally back home in the States working away. And it's great because it gets them an afternoon away from the castles, away from the museums and the sightseeing, and for the kids to play with the ball. So anybody from 8 or 9, 10 upwards in that range, a lot of Central European schools, which would be a school travel.
Really?
And we have,
when you say Central European,
I mean, sorry, when I say mainland European, so a lot of French, Austrian schools. We remarkably have been very successful in Denmark, and we have a very strong reputation, and a lot of very strong personal relationships in Denmark.
And how are you doing that? Do you email them or do you mail them? Or
we've spent some time traveling in Denmark and introducing Irish culture again via the medium of the games.
Is this you and Georgina?
Yes, okay. Indeed. Yeah, and we've had the opportunity to. Great opportunity to travel through some of the gymnasiums, effectively the secondary schools of Denmark, and introducing and discussing the values and different values of Danish culture versus Irish culture and its positives and negative aspects.
Do they realise that they were here before?
we often jest with them that the great Gaelic armies of Brian Boru assembled on the site in Nafina, just ready for the attack on the Viking settlement of Dublin on Good Friday. But that was 1,000 years ago, so it's taken them a while to get back. but they're back and welcomed in a different guise.
And you are, because I read from you that you're going off to Canada.
We're just about to join our Tourism Ireland cross-country sales mission. And we're travelling in May across from Canada. So we're travelling from Toronto all the way through to Calgary and on out to Vancouver and Victoria. And while Experience Gaelic Games provides a service or an opportunity or an activity for a half day's activities while our visitors to the island. If we don't have the visitors coming to the island in the first place, we don't have a market.
So
it's important that we generate it. And we also passionately believe that that it's the uniqueness of Irish cultural activities, be that through Gaelic games, be it through our music, be it through our dance, our language, our literature and our creativity. They are the really strong drivers, we believe, in having visitors choose to come to visit the island. And I think when we look at our competitive set across Europe and across India, across the world, you know, it's really not among counties or not among activities in Ireland that we're competing. It's competing against the beauty of and the ruggedness of Scotland, or indeed the cultural values of Wales or Brittany. Or indeed the great places in throughout Europe and in Switzerland. So I think it's important for us to emphasise and promote those things that make us
unique.
A little unique and different. Yeah. And we say it doesn't make us any better or any than anywhere else. But it makes it worth visiting.
Put a smile on my face and tell me, some of the reactions, and I haven't asked you this question, so I don't know what you're going to say, is the reactions to when they actually see hurling being played in full blood.
Well, we always introduce and the climax of our general introduction to it is to show some video clips of hurling being played at its most elite level to explain the what we say are the guidelines of the game rather than the rules. It's nicely referred to now by our coaches and by our staff as the Scared of Bejesus video. So I think that probably tells the story rather than the reactions. People are amazed of so many aspects of it, the ancientness of the game, the origins of the game, and particularly the success at the moment. It still remains remarkable, and sometimes I think we on the island don't celebrate it enough. It's remarkable to think that to celebrate our ancient stick and ball game, that we have more spectators gathered in Croke Park than there were spectators present for the last time the FIFA Soccer World Cup final was played, or indeed more spectators in the stadium on those days of our Gaelic football final than are attending the NFL Super Bowls. So I think we have an extraordinary cultural asset.
And it's amateur. Intrigue.
And absolutely. And
which is probably part of the reason why people do turn up, because they're no longer bothered with the cynics. You still haven't told me, which is curious, Cave de Hostientia, how much does this actually cost?
The most important bit comes around to it for the business show. The cost is €39 per person for a half day activity.
That seems like a reasonable deal.
Yeah, and it's and for our students, it's a little bit less. At €26, but it's a half day activity. But we have a big challenge, a very big challenge, and we've had since our launch, is that to try and encourage international visitors to engage in an activity to explain a cultural expression that they're unfamiliar with is extraordinarily difficult.
But do you not use us, the locals, as your ambassadors? Like if I say again, I didn't know about this, and I would have thought I should have known about it, and I would go and tell anybody who wants to come over to Ireland, you have got, if you've got any interest at all in sport in general, you've just got to go down and have a look at this.
Yeah, and I think that works to the limit who have direct contact with the island, but again, a significant amount of our visitors coming from overseas don't have that direct contact, and they make their choice based a lot of the way on stereotypical imagery. And indeed of perceptions of the island overseas. So I think that's a challenge. That's something for us all to work on. But we'll enjoy the battle of trying to communicate that.
And what would you like Team GBS, that's our listeners who are far flung far and wide, is there anything that they can do to help you?
Yeah, well, we'd love to promote anybody to have a look at our website at experiencegaelicgames.com. We particularly enjoy, I mentioned some of the segments we deal with. We also deal with a significant amount of corporate business. And we've had some great fun in entertaining some of our international corporate visitors, either be on incentive trips here to the island, or quite a considerable coming here for work functions. The idea of engaging with us, for internationals to come and engage with us for an experienced Gaelic game session, is an amazing team building and team bonding opportunity, particularly for those who haven't engaged in the games before, because it's very much a leveller, and it engages on many ways, intellectually, physically, and many other ways.
Yeah. I did mention four centres, Dublin, Galway, Cork and Belfast, but you're actually a little bit wider than that, aren't you?
Yeah, we have two mobile units on the road, so we travel up and down the length and breadth of the island, and so we work really with groups depending upon our corporate clients, depending where they are. So should we work in destinations which would be familiar to your visitors, the likes of Druids Glen or Farnham Estate, depending upon where conferences and particular events are, we bring our mobile units set up to work to it. Or we work in a range of local clubs throughout the island as well. Again, depending upon where sometimes a considerable amount of our visitors are time poor in their itineraries. So it's important that the location of the activity is stitched in with their itinerary.
And you're at 30,000 at the moment, well, pre-COVID. What's the dream? What would you like to hit 100,000 or maybe 82,000? Isn't that the number that goes into Croke Park?
Well, we really have, we have a lofty aspiration. And when we started off in 2009, I suppose maybe it's good to keep the lofty aspiration to us. But we would like to think that a sporting or a musical instrument would be a better representation internationally of Irish and Gaelic culture than necessarily the symbolism that's currently associated more widely internationally with
us. You're talking about Guinness or something like that, is it? Yeah.
Yeah.
And what is it you'd like, say, I was going to say Barack Obama, he's long gone. Next is Joe Biden, when he comes over. Would he come over and instead of going to the local boozer and to have that set-up shot, that he'd come down to you guys and you'd show him how to, handle early?
When
I'd say he'd be handy with one there.
Yeah, you know, when President Biden comes back, we'd like to take him to Cooley Kickham's rather than to the bar when he comes back up to Cooley and his roots in Finnegan's in Whitestown. And I think that would be, a more positive representation of Irish culture internationally while still combining all of the great passions of Irish culture, that idea of
Well, this belief. Podcast is going out on St. Patrick's Day, so I think that aspiration is probably a good idea, a nice one for this particular podcast. You have a final question. We ask it of all our Iona. Who would you, Cormac O'Donoghue, hire in a heartbeat?
A rather difficult one to think from our point of view, Conal, but on a little bit of reflection, there's one person who has achieved something which we never thought would be achievable, slightly related to Gaelic games. But I think if a man could make wearing O'Neill's shorts famous internationally,
I know you're going to talk about. Yeah,
I think that's something that that conveys a cultural significance very quickly in a very different way. So Paul Mescal, I think, would have to be the man you'd have to think you'd hire in a heartbeat. A man who played for Maynooth, who's very proud of his GAA roots.
And what was his stage name? Connell.
There we go. Actually, how could it be more appropriate than for the day that's in it?
Okay, well, Paul Mescal, you are wanted. He could be your mascot. Of course he would be. Yeah, he would be a great guy.
A great international face. And not only is he young, good-looking, but he seems to be a really nice guy as well. It makes us all feel a little bit jealous.
Cormac O'Donoghue, Gurv Míle Mágad, Techtar on Fud Creola, That Great Business Show.
Gurv Míle Mágad, Hain.
Make one small switch. Switching from shaving foam to all-natural de facto shaving oil will give you the smoothest, softest shave ever. Switching from shaving oil to de facto helps stop 20 million non-recyclable shaving foam cans go to landfills every year. Switching from shaving oil to de facto will save your skin, your pocket, and your planet. DeFactoShave.com.
Everyday accounting can be a bit of a drama for SMEs. However, BigRentCloud.com takes the drama away with its simple and easy-to-use cloud-based accounting and payroll software designed for SME owners. Raise and send invoices, manage VAT reports and obligations, run management reports, link directly to Irish banks, automatically import purchase invoices, and so much more. All with 5-star customer support. BigRentCloud.com, 100% Irish-owned and a proud member of Team GBS.
Small businesses often find it difficult to access the finance they need. Microfinance Ireland, the government-funded, not-for-profit lender, can help. We help businesses who've been unable to secure finance from banks or other lenders. We provide business loans up to €25,000 to businesses of less than 10 employees with a turnover of up to €2 million. For more information, visit microfinanceireland.ie or talk to your local enterprise office. Microfinance Ireland, funding small businesses in times of recovery and opportunity.
You're listening to That Great Business Show. ThatGreatBusinessShow.com.
I think that there are now around 41 distilleries in the country at the moment. I say I think because it seems a new distillery opens somewhere every couple of months, and I'm interested if there is room for them all. My next guest has been in and around the drinks industry for many decades. At one time, he was MD at Pernod Ricard in Ireland. He then climbed the greasy pole further, taking over as MD at Pernod Ricard UK. He left there in 2016, and since then, he's been advising others in the industry, including the Clonakilty Distillery, where he's been an independent director for the last 5 years. Welcome to That Great Business Show, Dennis O'Flynn.
Thank you, Colin. Thank you.
You've been at it a long time. First curiosity, you went in the HR door.
Yeah. How did I do that?
With a science degree.
Yeah. Yes, maybe if I go back far enough, I got into the drinks industry by way of an advertisement in the Irish Times back in the day. And I had just finished science in UCD. looking at the pharma industry, which was the place to go at the time. And this advert came up for a trainee brewer in the Guinness Group. Now, as a young, just about finished student, what better place to start? So, yeah, I was fortunate to be appointed as a trainee brewer in Smithwick St. Kilkenny back in the day, and worked through a number of the production functions. And at that point in time, there's a lot of industrial strife in Ireland, and I seem to be rather good at sorting that out. And ended up going into the HR function.
Were you a good talker or were you muscle?
I would say a bit of good talking and good listening. My wife might not say I'm as good a listener as I might want to be, but, you know, I think it's just listening to people. Somebody put it to me recently, actually, you were actually a good salesman. You were able to sell the concept of, you know, closures, redundancies at the time and all sorts of bad news. So that was probably a skill set.
Well, just having met you, I was able to see and hear immediately that you are good at selling and chatting. Right. So you get into HR through brewing, mm-hmm. and then you end up as MD of Ireland, then stroke UK.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
not bad.
No, not bad. No, if I roll back, that would have been around 1998, and Irish Distillers were looking for a new HR director at the time. I, at the time, was across the river in Guinness, in James's Gate. However, I was spotted or otherwise, somebody tapped me on the shoulder and said, we'd like to come across the river. So I moved into Irish Distillers as a HR director in 1998. I stayed in that function for about 9 or 10 years, I'm going to say, something of that nature. And then they were looking for somebody to look after the Irish market. So I was approached as somebody who both knew the market and knew the product. And I did that for a number of years. And then an opportunity arose to run the full operation for Pernod Ricard in the UK, which I did for
pretty chunky job.
Very chunky job. Yeah. No, it is. It's quite interesting for me now. I'm now working with Clonakilty Distillery down in Cork, which is a startup. And just looking at the size of marketing budgets in the two, you know, sometimes water comes into my eye when I think of what I used to have.
When you went into Irish Distillers the first time, how many distillers were there in Ireland, would you remember?
Ooh, about 4 or 5. So Cooley would have been in existence. Irish Distillers would have been Bushmills and perhaps 1 or 2 more.
And you corrected me because I looked up Mrs. Google, and Mrs. Google told me that there were 18 distilleries in Ireland now. Mm-hmm. You tell me that there are now 41. So Mrs. Google better get her act together.
That's correct.
That's an awful, awful lot of distilleries for a teeny little country.
It is. Now, I think you've got to take into account, you've got one very, very large organisation, which accounts for, I think, about 82% of all the whiskey that we produce. So that is a very big kid on the block. And there are two or three other big producers. So what you have now is, of your 41, I would suggest to you, you have about in excess of 20 of them that are quite artisan, small boutique players. Then you have a few medium range players, and then you clearly have the bigger brands, have some of the bigger players there.
But all the above artisans, mid-sized and the large ones, they're all competing. They're all probably trying to get bigger. Mm-hmm. So if we go directly to Clonakilty Distillery, run or owned by the Scully family,
yes.
They have world ambitions.
Yeah, well, it depends on how big your world is. I think the first thing we've got to look at is Irish whiskey as a category. And in that regard, is there scope for the category to grow? And there clearly is scope to grow. And in that regard, you know, the large mega brands are leading the way. But in doing so, they've created space for the smaller players to play. So while, the Irish distillers of this world have huge ambitions, so do we. And our percentage point is a completely, just to give you an idea, the whiskey, Irish whiskey is broadly about 92% what I would call the standard range of brands that we would all know. And then the premium and super premium account for 8% of the, i.e. the rest of the market. We'd be happy to get about 2% of that 8%.
So you would be deemed to be super premium, are you?
We would be deemed to be premium, certainly, yes. Our price point would be, you know, fairly up there. You're looking at a price point of around the €50 mark, that sort of space.
And the good news for you guys is that in 1 month's time, you will actually have your own whiskey.
Yes, happy birthday to us. Yes, absolutely.
Because it takes three years to get your designation as being an Irish whiskey, isn't that correct?
That's correct. That's correct.
But you have distilled it yourselves now, and
we have
held it in double barrels, is that right?
We've oak barrels. What we have actually, the enterprise in Clondalkilty is split into two locations. One is the distillery itself, which is built, actually, here's an interesting factoid for you. It's built in a former bank. So if you're going to sort of change the purposes of a high street bank, why not make it into a distillery, which is what we've done. And that's on the coast in Clondalkilty town. And about 5K out the coast towards Inchidonny, those people who'd been out that on that peninsula, is a place called Ardfield. And that is where the Scully family farm is. And that's where we warehouse our whiskey. So all the barrels that we have are up on headland there on the family farm.
And I saw the marketing that you sell me on your website is that I leave with salt on my lips or something from if you go and visit there, isn't that right?
Yeah. Yes. Well, what we have is we're growing barley on the literally on the seashore there. Again, if you know the Galleyhead and Red Strand area,
it's and part of the most beautiful place on earth, I'd say.
It's beautiful.
On a sunny day.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. No, it is. It's a beautiful, beautiful place. And in that regard, the soil has got to be, you know, salt infused, maritime infused. And one of the other interesting facts is that we started out with a heritage barley because we're growing our own barley. But we said we'd go with the style of barley that was grown in Ireland 100 years ago. And we got 1 kilo of a varietal called Goldthorpe. This year we have 40 tons of it, and we will be doing our own distillate from that, and that will be our super premium product in 3, 4, 5 years' time.
Now, you have been, as I mentioned at the very beginning, many decades at this. And it is my view, my personal view, it's not based on anything else, that so much around the drinks industry is simply marketing. So when you, this is brand new to me about your varietals and everything else, that is just giving me a further backstory about to make me say that's a better drink than that. But at the end of the day, can you actually tell much of a difference? There will be a difference.
I think you can. I mean, certainly we would all have our preference for whatever brand we like, and we like it for a reason. And
what is that reason? Because I remember, again, probably when you were in Irish Distillers, wasn't it Bushmills had that strap line about all those long beer drinking days while you were waiting for your taste buds to mature or something like that? I thought that was one of the cleverest pieces of advertising I had seen.
Yeah.
But what are you actually telling me? You're not telling me anything at all about the drink. You're telling me that I'm a great guy because my taste buds have matured.
I'm not. No. I mean, what I'm saying...
No, sorry, that was that ad telling you.
Oh, yes. Oh, that's what that ad was telling you. Oh, yes, sorry, Colin. No. I think that you will find, I mean, very simply, if you look at your typical Scotch whiskey, which has that peated notes to it, it is quite different from the Irish whiskies that you'd be familiar with. And even in that context, you've what are called the grain whiskies and pot still whiskies. And pot still would be what we would like to see as sort of the traditional style of Irish whiskey. And it becomes a slightly more problematic process the bigger you get. So there is space in behind the larger producers for smaller producers like Clonakilty to produce a pot still. And when you talk about brand stories, I mean, we do have a Scully family who have been on that farm for 320 years. We still do have 300 cows on the farm. We are maritime. So in the sense of what's real, we are growing our own barley. So do we have a story that we are able to stand over the provenance, the sustainability and everything that people are talking about now? Yes. So in that regard, I think our chance of success is significantly higher.
So then you cross the Atlantic with your distillations, and because you also make a gin and a vodka, and you then start knocking on doors. And we've done enough items on this podcast about this to know it's a ferociously difficult market to break into.
Exceedingly difficult. And if I were giving advice to a startup going in, having now been at this for the last, 3 years with Clonakilty, go where the unloved are. In other words, the larger brands colonize the larger cities. There's more than enough to play for in a country like the US. The US has a significant advantage in understanding spirits and understanding brown spirits, and they're also not shy about paying for spirits in that regard. So there's lots of opportunity, providing you stay a little bit off the beaten track.
But there you go again, saying understanding spirits.
Yes.
People, I think it was Moore MacDougall, economist, who taught me a long time ago that you don't go to a bar for a pint, you go for the ambiance. Now, fellas actually do go, I don't think Moore quite got this, they do go there for the pints. Mm. And if the pints, Weatherspoon has proven that if pints are cheap, it attracts a certain audience.
That's true.
So when you go and into the heartland of the USA and tell them about Clonakilty, of which they have never heard, probably Ireland, which is probably touch and go, Samfire, all that stuff, surely they just say, as Ernest Hemingway used to say, how drunk will it make me?
Well, good question. And one of the success factors for Clonakilty in the States, if I may, is that we've done a number of collaborations. So we have identified local craft brewers. And we
in the States?
In the States.
Because I saw this on your website. That was very clever.
Yeah. Thank you. So what we do is we take, we will select a beer that we like and think will marry well with our product. We will get an empty cask from that, or we take them in fours because that's what fits on a pallet. We air freight them back to Clonakilty and we fill them with our whiskey and we leave them in that for about 1 year. Then we bottle the whiskey and we send it back. Now, what that does for us is it allows us to go to market and saying, if you like that craft beer, you'll also like that craft whiskey because we co-label them and co-collaborate with them. So we use their name over there, they use our name. So that works well for both parties.
Go on, admit it. That was your big idea, was it?
It wasn't. I'm not going to claim that one.
That's a lovely idea.
Yeah, it works very, very well. I think we've done, I think, 14 different collaborations in that. And in fact, we've done one in Ireland, if I can name check.
Of course you can.
O'Hara's and Carlo. So ourselves and O'Hara's have done a co-collaboration.
And is that on the shelf yet?
It is absolutely on the shelf, and it has won a number of awards. So you can do it wherever you want to do it.
I had somebody from the advertising industry on recently, and we both agreed that if you're not an award-winning advertising agency, you don't exist. Mm-hmm. So similarly, the numbers of awards that are available to distillers, distilleries, etc., there are many.
There are, but I think what I have learned in the industry, more pertinent probably to wine than to spirits, is that certainly on supermarket shelves, people for a point of differentiation do look at medals, do look at things as a badge, because a lot of people are looking for that brand to reflect them, whatever their them is, and that's why the awards, and it is your peers recognizing you.
Now, go back to the this idea in the States with the craft brewers. Mm. When I imagine a craft brewer, I'm thinking of a two-person operation down in wherever, Carlo, whatever. Mm. I presume these are big craft brewers, are they?
Well, now, that you raise a very interesting question. In the US, the definition of a craft brewer could be a rather, rather large entity. That said, no, we identify smaller craft brewers. So if I take, for an example, Sean Scully, who'd be the ninth generation Scully, and he runs our operation in Oregon. He's identified a brewery there, the Pelican Brewery in Oregon, in Portland in Oregon, and we've sort of done a collaboration with them equally up in
sorry, what is in it for Pelican brand?
As I say, this idea that there's a whiskey now that relates to the beer that they have. So, I mean, if you look at a lot of the craft, and particularly the US craft movement, there's a lot of conversations going on around what makes things different, et cetera, et cetera. And it's sort of pretty cool to have a beer, your favorite beer that you've been talking about now has a first cousin that is a whiskey, you know, linked to it. And it is that barrel from, in this case, Portland, Oregon, winging its way back to Clonakilty and winging its way back again. So it is pretty cool. Not everybody can do that.
And when you are shipping to Portland, Oregon, or wherever, air freight, container freight?
Oh no, we air freight the empty barrel back because you can't let the barrel dry out.
Okay.
Once the barrel dries out, it's gone.
It opens up.
Yeah. Okay. So that's the only reason for the air freight.
When you're shipping out?
We bottle, we'll take, we'll put whiskey into the barrel. we'll mature it on our warehouse on the family farm for, as I say, upwards of a year, and then we will bottle it. We have our own bottling operation, so it'll go back out
as a bottled
whiskey. Yeah.
The one country that I'm failing to hear from at the moment, Britain. Are you in Britain or?
Yes, we are. Yeah. No, the UK is an interesting market, and as you referenced there, having run Pernod Ricard over there for 5 years, I'd be very well connected in that regard. We are in the UK, and we're continuing to look to expand in the UK.
Any clever bits of marketing there? Have you tied in with any of the craft brewers over there, for example?
Not yet. I was going to say that our timing was a little bit off as far as we went into the UK at the back end of 2019. And then this little bug came around the corner and threw all our plans a bit awry. So we've sort of done a re-entry into the UK.
And how does it affect you going into the UK? Like, you are you given different duties or different taxation levels, or?
Oh yeah, you'll any. I mean, the bulk of Irish whiskey is exported globally.
Sure.
So it's exported sort of under bond, as it were, and must go into another bonded warehouse. So the duties will apply in the jurisdiction in which you are.
I understand that, but Brexit, what has that meant for you? Has it increased costs or just complexity? Well,
I think a couple of things. I think, if I'm honest, and I think it's well documented, particularly on the transportation side, some elements of Brexit have sort of shot the UK market in the foot, in the sense of when I was over there recently, they're still short of 100,000 drivers in the UK. So, logistics is problematic. Getting your product picked from a warehouse can be problematic. But we've managed to get over that. We've managed to identify a couple of warehousing operations that do work in that regard. And in that regard, you've got a sort of cluster where you're going to send your product. So you'll send it to the urban areas because that's where you can get at. Brexit itself has posed some difficulties in the sense of ease of administration and ease of transportation. There's no doubt about that.
You better keep the Clonakilty boys happy now by telling me about their huge ambitions. What's next for the company?
What's next for the company is I've created a T-shirt with SIPS24 on it. Single Irish Pot Still 2024. And getting back to the maturation of whiskey question, while legally it takes 3 years, if you're looking at a pot still whiskey, which is using raw barley as well as malted barley, it typically, certainly in my world, takes 5 to 6 years to mature. And in that regard, I think I've told you that we will have whiskey in 2022. So we're looking at sort of 2024, so 2025. So our great goal is to have a single Irish pot still available to the marketplace in 2024.
And why are you choosing, say, a pot still whiskey? Do you just look at the segments and say, look, there's the gap?
Two things. I referred earlier on to the idea that there's only 8% of the marketplace that is in that premium and super premium, and pot stills will over-index in that.
I don't know. That's marketing terminology. Over-index.
Yes. In other words, if you're looking at the other 92%, the other 92% is broadly what is called blended whiskey, blended Irish whiskey that we all know. That same percentage doesn't transfer into the premium market, where a larger percentage of the premium market is pot still whiskey. So therefore, if you're looking to attract a price, it's probably more, an easier proposition. The second reason for going down the pot still road, to be honest with you, is you have, as you can imagine, you have three pot stills, which allows you to do a batch process, whereas the other column distillation is a continuous process. So in our case, the batch process allows us to do two brews a day by 5 days. Now we are going on to 7 days, actually, from next month.
And you better give a shout out as well to the visitors centre. Now, I haven't been there. I've been to the Teeling one, and the Teeling one is brilliant. But I saw something again on the website about dipping the dog.
Yes. Yeah, well, yes, you can do that. That is a brewing phrase. That's right. It's when you're sampling a whiskey. Our visitor centre, again, COVID severely impacted it in the first 2 years. So, yeah, we have a visitor centre and a gin school. So if you're...
And the gin school, you can make your own gin.
Correct.
With your own botanicals.
Correct.
So you can, and then can you label it as well?
You can. You can.
I've done mine.
Yeah,
really,
you have. Yeah, no, it's pretty cool. I mean, it's basically you can. What we do is we deconstruct a gin, and there are elements that must go into a gin by, you know, they just, and then there are other elements that would generally go into a gin. So we sort of describe it like a pizza. The base you got to put in, that tomato piece you probably should put in. And then the topping is whatever you want to do. So whatever botanicals you like, you put in. So it takes about 3 hours. It's great fun. And if you're down in that part of the world, it is wonderful. We would hope this year in the visitor centre to welcome between 5,000 and 10,000 visitors. We hope, depends entirely on how the country recovers over the summer.
Which is a huge number of people if you think of the size of Clonakilty. Am I right in saying Clonakilty is about 2,500 people in the world?
Probably closer to four, and then it would grow a little bit as you'll appreciate in the summertime. But it's a wonderful area in the regard of the type of visitor down there. Very much, you know, artisan foods. You know, are happy to pay for their dwellings and their so in that regard, coming to the distillery, we would hope that their pockets are deeper than most.
But of course, so longer term, I'm going to listen very carefully to the answer of this one. Would it be the ambition to grow and then flip the business?
Now, that's interesting. The short answer is hopefully not, but never say never. And why do I say that? The shareholders that are in the business now are very much long-term individuals. The Scully family, as I say, have been in Clonakilty for over 300 years, so they're not going anywhere anytime soon. And our aspiration is to stay independent. That said, the big single challenge for a new kid on the block is your access to markets. So if there were a larger player who were interested, we would, of course, have to listen to what they might do. So I think the only place we might think in terms of is if there were a larger player who could give us access to market that we are unlikely to do on our own.
I wonder, is there space, and I've only just thought of this, is there space for a board bagne of booze, board booze, that would actually lead... Or is there any...
Bourbia. Yeah, Bourbia do a very good job in the sense of, I mean, they've been traditionally, I think, linked to dairy and meat sectors, but they're getting increasingly involved in marketing of the Ireland brand. I'm on the boards of Drinks Ireland for my sins, and the Irish Whiskey Association also are looking at the category play as against the brand play. So they're very clear about broadening out that category. And so there are a couple of players in there, but yes, we'll always take any help we can get.
Okay, well, listen, I could talk to you for the next couple of hours about this. It's a fascinating business, really, isn't it? And forever changing?
It's forever changing. I remember when we got married first and we were living in Kilkenny.
Is this me and you?
Myself and my darling wife. But if you're going to dinner parties, it was far more interesting to talk to somebody from the drinks industry than other professions, perhaps.
Final question to you, Dennis O'Flynn. Who would you hire in a heartbeat?
Who would I hire in a heartbeat? Joey Carberry.
Okay.
Joey Carberry, because we are based in Munster and looking to break out of that. And I think Joey also is very clearly based in Munster. Also, I refer to 2024. I think there's an opportunity for us with the Pot Still Whiskey in 2024. And I think if looking at the Irish rugby team, I think Joey will post the World Cup, be looking to get himself out and about in 2024.
I see what you're doing. You're actually offering him a job.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
So a lot of people who, you say hire in a heartbeat, they're talking about Richard Branson and people like this.
I know.
And they're never going to come over.
No, absolutely.
But Joey Carberry, we'll pass this on.
Absolutely,
He can send a CV to you, to Dennis O'Flynn, who's the director at Clonakilty Distillery, and many other hats as well. Dennis O'Flynn, thank you so much for joining us on That Great Business Show.
Thank you.
Of travel? If so, make sure to make Defacto, the world's best shaving oil, your choice of travel companion. A 25 milliliter bottle of Defacto means no hassle at airports, no bulky cans to carry, and the guarantee of the world's best shave. DefactoShave.com.
Small businesses often find it difficult to access the finance they need. Microfinance Ireland, the government-funded, not-for-profit lender, can help. We help businesses who've been unable to secure finance from banks or other lenders. We provide business loans up to €25,000 to businesses of less than 10 employees with a turnover of up to €2 million. For more information, visit microfinanceireland.ie or talk to your local enterprise office. Microfinance Ireland, funding small businesses in times of recovery and opportunity.
Everyday accounting can be a bit of a drama for SMEs. However, BigRentCloud.com takes the drama away with its simple and easy-to-use cloud-based accounting and payroll software designed for SME owners. Raise and send invoices, manage VAT reports and obligations, run management reports, link directly to Irish banks, automatically import purchase invoices, and so much more. All with five-star customer support. BigRentCloud.com, 100% Irish-owned and a proud member of Team GBS.
If the civilized world is to defeat Putin's Russia, we've got to keep the home fires burning and keep the wheels of industry turning. It's with that in mind that we've asked an expert in all matters energy to join us today to give us some facts-based views on how the West can quickly shift away from its dependency on Russian oil and gas. David Horgan is chairman of Petrel Resources, an Irish-based explorer with interest in Iraq and Ghana, and he's been in the exploration business for as long as I've known him, which is quite a while. So it's fair to say he knows an awful lot about the energy business. David Horgan, Fáil Tú Go Dtí, That Great Business Show.
Good morning, Margaret.
David, fill me full of some positivity about what can we do, should the Russians switch off gas and or oil?
Well, I should start by saying that the Russians have been a very reliable supplier for 50 years, both as the Soviet Union and as Russia itself. Amazingly reliable, actually. There's only two interruptions to gas, and both times it was the Ukrainians who stole some of our gas going through the transit pipeline, which is the reason why they built Nord Stream 1 and 2 and then the Trans-Turk pipeline, which skirts around Ukraine. So up to now, there hasn't been a problem. But the worry is that 10 days ago, we imposed the strictest financial sanctions ever imposed on a developed economy. And the fear would be that now the Russians will lash out and they will put in a temporary or selective embargo, maybe for the rest of this year. If I were them, I'd probably do it. If they do it, obviously, it would destroy their good reputation as a supplier. And remember, business and war are quite separate. The very day that the attack was launched on Ukraine, that February 24th, what else happened that day? Russia started supplying through the transit pipeline. And the reasons why? Because the European utilities have an option under the contract. They call it the option. And rather than default on their option, Gazprom started supplying them through the Ukrainian pipeline. And of course, the Ukrainians were happy to take the transit fees, which shows you that capitalism always wins in the end. You can kill people above ground and supply them below ground.
But they're rule breakers, obviously. They don't accept international decency or anything like that. Now, I'm not talking about Russians, I'm talking about Putin. Why would he bother trying to fulfill obligations, stick by contracts? Why does he not just give the order, cut the gas pipeline now?
Well, the fact is that they have been a reliable supplier, not just of oil and wood pulp and gas and metals. And they had opportunities where they could have put the squeeze on, and so they didn't take those opportunities. Now, whether they enjoyed the hard currency, whether they put great store by contracts, Russians I've dealt with have always been people of their word. So, you know, they might kill you, but at the same time, they'll honor the contract. That's their mentality. And to dismiss them as stupid or dishonorable or mad, I think is lazy analysis. Try to understand them as they are.
Oh, I'm not suggesting any of the above, I hope. What I'm trying to understand is it's a dichotomy, isn't it? Is that they are willing to go to war, but they are willing to supply gas.
Well, the same happened in Syria during the civil war. There were situations where Daesh held gas fields and the Assad regime held the power plant, and deals were done at local level to continue shipping the gas to the power plant, and the power plant continued shipping electricity to the communities under Daesh oppression. In those cases, I understand the deals were done by local business people. So it wasn't Daesh speaking to the regime. It was the local Gombin man sorting it out with his friend in the next village. But the fact is, the deals were done.
Russia does depend hugely for its income as a country on energy sales. So in another sense, in a further twist to it, you could say that if they stopped selling, well, it's going to damage themselves. Would that be a reasonable analysis?
Yeah, but they went into this illegal invasion with $850 billion of foreign exchange earnings. Now, some of them could have been expropriated, but, you know, they've tooled up for this. This was a plan. I mean, they're chess players. They planned for this. They probably don't expect a long war, and it probably won't be a long war. But, you know, the Russians are people that can suffer. Look at their history. 27 million dead in 4 years during World War II. So you're not going to sweat them out.
We cannot either switch to other suppliers very quickly, can we?
And purely for reasons of our own bad policy,
just 7 years ago, it's hard to imagine, but 7 years ago, Ireland was one of the hotspots for gas exploration in the world. And the reason was the Canadians and similar rocks across the Atlantic had had a series of discoveries, and Irish rocks are very similar. Also, there had been a series of discoveries offshore West Africa in the Cretaceous rocks, which we also have. And there was a flood of interest into Ireland in the most successful bid round we've ever had, 2015. 17 top companies, 49 blocks acquired. The companies very aggressively started acquiring seismic. There were multiple drill targets planned. Ourselves, with our partner Woodside, the biggest company in Australia, had multiple targets. And we were literally tooling up, getting ready to mobilise, to drill several targets, when along came Leo Varadkar, goes to the General Assembly, makes a speech announcing that we're going to get out of oil exploration without telling his department officials, apparently without telling his cabinet. And with that, the industry basically stopped dead, because I can't go to a board or an institutional investor in London and say, give me 200 million to drill a well, because they'll say the government's against you, and they'd be right.
So we ain't going to find our own gas. Can we find other sources of gas and or oil?
Well, in Europe, the North Sea is in rapid decline now. It's been a very good province, but it's in rapid decline. There'll be a couple of small fields here and there that can be drilled out.
Can you turn up the tap quickly? In other words, I'm trying to look for what can you replace the oil and the gas from Russia with?
Well, only liquefied natural gas. Ben, liquefied natural gas is not piped, but what you do is you take stranded gas, Northwest Shelf of Australia, like our partners Woodside, or Algeria, or Egypt, or Russia or United States now, and you purify it, you compress it to 600 atmospheres, and then it's quite stable, believe it or not. People think it's a bomb, but it's actually quite stable when it's liquid, and then you ship it to a receiving station. Now, it's a big capital investment on the liquefaction side, about 5 billion euro. On the receiving side, like Shannon LNG, it's about 350 million euro, relatively more straightforward plant. And with that technology, we can supply Ireland, in theory, well. Our problem is that our current minister is opposed to the development of these facilities, even though the German Greens are building two such facilities. You couldn't make this up.
Let us say that a ship pulls into Australia, takes the gas on board, ships it to Ireland, and then we unload it. Is that one possible, feasible at the moment? Mm-hmm. As we stand, we have all of the capability to do so.
Well, we have to build the actual plant for which you need permission.
So we haven't got it?
No. But and you can build it within 3 or 4 years if we have all the permissions.
Yeah, 3 or 4 years is a long time.
It's quick by this industry standards.
And let us say that the facility was there. Could you, how long does it take to physically ship to move from A to B, from Australia up into Poland port in Ireland?
It should be about 45 days. From North Africa, maybe less than 10 days.
So if we have not got the facilities here, can we get the same LNG, ship it into somewhere in Europe, and then take it off a grid?
Well, we are on the end of two interconnectors through Scotland. And in past interruptions, the Scots continued to serve the Irish market under contract, and they actually displaced big industrial users in Britain that in their contract had the ability to displace them up to a certain point. However, Priti Patel, when Home Secretary, announced that they were contemplating squeezing Ireland with medicines and food as part of the pressure on the Brexit issue, which remains very much a live issue. So I wouldn't count on the British continuing to supply us in an emergency.
But did you say it's coming through Scotland? Maybe Mrs. Sturgeon could look after us a little bit better.
Well, unfortunately, Scotland is itself now an importer. Everyone thinks Britain is an exporter, which it was, but now it's an importer. And the British are in a state of complacency, as we are. They think that they're not dependent on Russian gas. What they don't grasp is that, first of all, the price on these contracts is nearly always set by the European hub, which is on the German-Dutch border, and that's driven by the Russian gas supply price. Also, I know from my own friends in trading oil in Norway that they may have a contract to service Centrica, which is the old British gas. But one thing is the contract. When they're actually coming to supply the contract, they don't physically take molecules from Norway and send them out of pipeline to Britain. What they do is they go into the market and buy gas that's available. So the British mix is effectively the same as every other European mix, and the same for Spain and the other markets. So Britain actually is vulnerable to Russian gas, though it doesn't know it.
But if 45% of the gas is coming from Russia into Europe, correct? And I think it's for Germany, it's 65% or something like that. And if that is cut off, is there, I'm being utterly simplistic now, is there a little pipe anywhere that can be connected into anywhere else that will ship gas or oil or LNG or any other form of energy to serve Europe?
No, I mean, there's two pipelines from Algeria, one on to sea, one through Morocco. But believe it or not, the Moroccan one has been shut down in recent months because there's a row between Algeria and Morocco over the French colonial border. I was just with the ambassador a couple of weeks ago. He explained all this to me. There's also a small pipeline through.
Well, sorry, can that be reopened? Let's say that they settle their differences. So if the cash was divvied out, that could reopen.
Yeah.
But could that serve enough, or would be enough in that to service Europe?
No, I think that between the two of them, it's about it's less than 30 billion cubic meters. So it's about half the new Nord Stream 2. You know, we need the new Nord Stream 2 to flow.
But that's not going to happen now for the while.
Well, the Germans have been very careful. If you read judiciously what they say, they have they've postponed the final certification, but the pipeline's built.
Okay. You mooch with the people, these kinds of people who may have insights that obviously I have no idea at all of. If you were a betting man, one, are we going to see blackouts? Two, how long will it last? Any ideas at all?
We will see blackouts, and we will react by building facilities to diversify our gas supply.
Come on stream in 2, 3, 4, 5 years?
Well, let's push the button now. Like, it'll be the 1970s.
For people who don't understand what
it'll
that means,
three-day
week,
stagflation.
UK basically shut down.
Yeah, and the inflation's already taken off. If you look at any of the prices, coal, $60 a ton 18 months ago, now over $400. Right across the board, wheat has by 60% up, nickel, copper, you name it, they're all up. Gas was $2 in January 2021. This morning it was $41. And whoa, those prices have not yet been passed on to the consumer, but they will be.
That's a big ouch. So you are a citizen of this country. You would be facing the same blackouts as anybody else here. What is David Horgan going to do when the lights are switched off and the heating goes off?
Well, you can burn turf, coal.
You can't, because we're not cutting turf, remember?
Well, people will go out and cut their own turf, Lishkian. But I think we'll have to. The last two governments have simply been incompetent. Their incompetence, at least in the energy field, and the way they've allowed an anti-business sentiment to rise, really should displace them from power. And we need to radically change our political system.
That's a different chat for a different day, maybe on a different podcast. What? Give me some ray of hope.
Never bet against the entrepreneurship of the industry. If you look at what the Americans did, last time there was a price surge in the early noughties, they went from America producing about 5 million barrels a day to America now being within touching position of being self-sufficient. And that's not due to the majors. That's not due to any national oil corporation. That's Irish-American companies like Quintana and the Mitchells and people like that simply experimenting in garages with high-pressure pumps, trying out acids, trying a different treatment. That's the fracking revolution. And we could do the same thing in Europe. I mean, rocks could be fracked up on the Leitrim, Fermanagh, Roscommon border. Large parts of Britain could be fracked. Poland could be fracked. France could be fracked.
But that also, doesn't matter how you mix it or chop it, that's going to take another chunk of time.
Well, Britain has two wells concreted in that were flowing gas, which an order came from just last week to concrete over, and they've got a stay of execution for a few months. So Britain could start some fracking production right away.
Enough to supply what?
A major English town.
That's not really going to keep anybody warm and or with the lights on or hospitals open or anything like that.
So the sooner we move, the better it is. I mean, if you wanted to diversify from Russia, you wouldn't start from here.
We try to be positive on that great business show, and you've wrecked my buzz, as they say. There must be something out there that we could hang on to.
Well, if you look at the situation in 2019, Ireland had the major oil and gas companies in the world here. You name it, the who's who. They were ready to drill to multiple targets. You could reverse policy and you could convince them that this time we will stand by our word. The problem is they're going to be suspicious that when the Ukraine crisis is solved, we're going to screw them again. Mm. And not just the oil and gas industry. I know for a fact that, you know, Intel and others are also watching Ireland, and Ireland has taken a lot of anti-business hits in the recent months. The loss of Intel, all the problems with server farms being connected, and the 12.5% tax rate, which every American treasurer understands because it's so simple and so well communicated by the IDEA and others, that's in jeopardy too. So Ireland's turning against business.
Come here to me before we let you go, and I might push you out the door because you're being so negative on me, is who would David Horgan hire in a heartbeat?
To me, the best hire you could possibly make is a youngster with fire in their belly, who's prepared to work partly or wholly for sweat equity. And this was told to me by the great equine vet Stan Cosgrove. And you know what? I'm trying to hire his grandson now, first class student geologist. The problem with the really motivated and bright people is that they've always got lots of projects, so it's difficult to persuade them.
You better name him, because you won't know that you're looking for him.
His name is Loman Begley, and I'd hire him before Elon Musk and Mick O'Leary.
Oh, that's some recommendation. Loman Begley, maybe he should come in and join us on that podcast, on this podcast, so that we'll get some future insights. So, Loman Begley, you're very welcome to join us here. And David Horgan, Chairman of Petrel Resources, thank you so much for joining us. And that is it from That Great Business Show, episode 79. Please share, like, retweet this podcast with all of your connections on social media. And do it now, please, before you forget. It's a click of a button for you. It's commercial success for us. Make it easy on yourself to enjoy your favorite business podcast by also pressing the subscribe button. And of course, you can always talk to us on our LinkedIn page. Great brands like Big Red Cloud, Microfinance Ireland, ISME, Virgin Media, Uderosna Goethe advertise with us. They're all Team GBS approved, so please give them your commercial backing. And if your business would like to advertise on what you say is Ireland's best business podcast, do get in touch with us today. As always, my thanks to all of the team here at the Dublin Podcast Studios, including today's super sound engineer, David Murray. Later on, Peter Rice will add some extra long whooshes to the show. Listen out for them as they help make us the world's best-sounding podcast. And as always, the great business insights you hear on That Great Business Show are only made possible thanks to our sponsor, the great makers of the world's best shaving oil, De Facto, made in Mayo, sold worldwide. And don't forget to buy Business Plus magazine, where we now have a regular column all about the podcast. So for me, Conal Moran, Vor Mila Berchus Vegeistachlin, Agus Slán Tamil.